What do you picture when you think of invisibility? Maybe it's Harry and his invisibility cloak, or Violet from The Incredibles.
For season 5 of Modcast, we'll be stepping beyond the world of fiction and into the world of fact.
I'm Malvika.
And I'm Sam. Join us as we go full incognito to look into invisibility in all its shapes and forms.
Welcome to Planet Earth, a world that is full of invisible people, processes, places, and things.
But before we look further, we must ask, what does invisibility look like in this world?
Hey Sam, so what's on for today?
Hey Malvika, well today I'm going to rock your world with this episode of the Modcast. We're going to be looking at some of Planet Earth's invisible processes.
Can you tell us a bit more? How's it going to rock my world?
Well, on today's episode, we'll be looking into two of the many invisible processes the Earth has to offer. The first, geology, and some subtopics of the geology category.
Wait, did he just make a rock joke?
The second, glaciology, and to help us to understand these processes are Tom Raimondo and Nathan Teeter. Tom is a professorial lead for STEM at the University of South Australia and is the Associate Professor for Geology and Geochemistry. Nathan is currently a PhD student at the University of Adelaide, where he is studying glaciology and oceanography.
Wow, sounds like we have some pretty interesting guests on today's episode. But tell me, what exactly is glaciology?
Simply put, it's the study of glaciers. But let's hear Nathan's definition.
So glaciology is mainly the study of, well, in this case, the physical study of glaciers, ice sheets, ice shelves, and how they change over time.
Right. I imagine that in the world's current climate or changing of climate, glaciology would not only be extremely relevant, but also really needed in the understanding of what is happening in the present and future of the world's climate.
Indeed it is. When I spoke to Nathan, he was quite intrigued by the concept of glacial shifts and climate change in relation to being one of the world's invisible processes.
How so?
Well, scientifically speaking, it is one of the most visible out of all of the processes on the Earth because we are able to regularly see the changes that are studied in glaciology as they happen. Here, have a listen. So, Nathan, does glaciology fall into the category of being one of Earth's invisible processes?
Oh, yes, it does. So, no, glaciology tends to be... It was because when you said that question about the invisible thing, where glaciology tends to be the one where it's probably most visible. So you've got the stuff like, for instance, I mean, the obvious one is ice just melting and being removed away from a system and put in the ocean. Stuff like, as well as it being damaged. So, well, absolutely it does.
Wow, I wouldn't even have thought of that. Are there many more invisible processes in the study of glaciology?
Well, I mean, there is. So, is that the thing I mentioned earlier? I mean, as well as ice melting, you can talk about, in this case, sea ice as well. So the sea ice buffer, the sea ice in the area is retreating, which you can measure through satellites and that. And that can also, again, give a clue that you said you've got that at, in this case, an albedo decrease, which can actually probably go back a little bit. Albedo is probably another way to measure it. So if you can see a lot of damage on an ice shelf or an ice sheet, that's lowering the amount of reflectivity an ice has. So that's absorbing heat as well, and that will trigger... That will kind of give a feedback loop, so that's another way you can see it, though that some of that damage does happen naturally.
So, as we can see, there is a lot more to glaciology than just the ice melting. It is important that while we are fully aware of climate change and that the world's ice is melting because of that, we still need to respect glaciology and its studies as an invisible process. It is a lot deeper than just the Earth's processes being invisible.
One of the most significant invisible processes seen in this field has nothing to do with planet Earth. It's about the people. In the field of glaciology and STEM in general, there is a considerable underrepresentation of women and their works.
Recently, an article called Gendered Barriers to Australian Antarctic Research and Remote Fieldwork explores some of the immense difficulties women face in accessing the resources to conduct their own glaciological research. It's important to note that both us and the researchers of the article acknowledge that gender is not binary, is socially produced, self-identified, and complex.
Studies shown throughout this article explore how, even though more women are entering glaciology and polar science, the field is still predominantly associated with quote-unquote heroic white masculine figures.
As many of our listeners will someday be our future researchers or leaders, we have to make sure that equality in whatever field of study is there. To bridge the gendered barriers discussed in this article would ensure the important people that aren't being recognised can emerge from their invisibility and receive the recognition that they deserve.
So Sam, we've spoken a bit about glaciology and its invisible processes, but how exactly does that affect us?
Here, let me get Nathan to explain some of the impacts that we can see.
Albedo. So this one where we see one thing that this mentioned probably is worth mentioning is now if you lower the albedo of ice because you've lost it or it breaks down, that'll in turn cause more heat to be absorbed. So that will cause a warming effect instead of being reflected. So that will then eventually, with enough of it, flow back through and warm the earth up. And that will inevitably have an impact with crops or sea surface temperature, which will impact fisheries. So that's one. I mean, another impact would be sea level rise. So whilst, for instance, the event I mentioned earlier with an ice shelf disintegration, that won't directly increase sea level rise just because an ice shelf is floating on water and has already been balanced out through buoyancy. It does actually, what it does is that it does slow down the ice sheet from flowing out to the sea. So because ice is a fluid, it moves. And if you have more ice there, it will slow down its movement. So that's another potential impact that will inevitably come through, and then that will impact eventually as it goes through a system, impact places like Adelaide, which are on a coastline, and eventually we lose our beaches, or we're forced to choose which ones we want.
I think Nathan raises a really important point of how climate change and its impact on ice is and can affect us here in South Australia.
Definitely. It's really devastating to see the changes that it's already made.
I have someone else that can tell us a little bit more about how important South Australia is in understanding the world's invisible processes. But before we look too close to home, I want to introduce Tom Raimondo to tell us exactly how we can look to geology and geochemistry to see invisible processes.
If you take the Antarctic coast, that interface between the ice and rock underneath is kilometres beneath the surface. No one could ever directly observe it. That's part and parcel really of many geological processes if you think about it. Most of the things that we experience on the surface of the Earth are really, like if you think of the Earth as an egg, basically it's really just that, the eggshell on the outer part and really just scratching the surface of that if you really want to think about it in absolute terms. So there's the entire rest of the egg, if you like, the interior of the Earth, that we never ever will see. We never ever have the opportunity to directly observe. And we need to rely on indirect observations in order to build an understanding or build a picture of what that looks like. And that's where geologists rely on things that we call geophysical techniques, which are ways that we can image the subsurface, build up a bit of an understanding of what's going on there based on all of these indirect observations that we can derive. And so all of that is invisible. All of that is unknown in some way without that direct observation that we can provide. The other thing about geology, of course, is that it occurs over timescales which are effectively unobservable in our human experience, right? We talked about scratching the surface in terms of the depth that which we can directly sample. Think about time frames. Our human experience is the blink of an eye in terms of the entirety of the Earth's existence. And so we need to grapple with processes occurring over time frames that we really have no perspective on, no concept of how large they are. And so if you could extend the invisibility concept, I guess, to that, we've never perceived directly the kind of timescales at which the Earth has operated over billions of years.
Some of the stuff that Tom talked about was pretty difficult to understand, but if you really think about it, he was right. The Earth kind of is just one big egg.
It absolutely is, and he was right again in saying we have barely scratched the surface.
So how exactly do geologists do the mental gymnastics and understand how the planet works, if most of it has happened over millions and millions of years?
Well, I'll get Tom to explain it to you himself, but basically, geologists have to conduct the only form of time travel possible to humans.
Since when can humans time travel?
Since geology.
There's a concept that we use all the time in geology, which is called the principle of uniformitarianism. That's a big word, but all it really means, in a nutshell, is that the present is the key to the past. And so the observations that we make in the present day about how long things take, about how rocks evolve, about how minerals grow, what we effectively do as geologists is we extrapolate that into the past, and we presume that the things we observe today are kind of the very similar in many respects as to what happened in the past. And so that enables us to at least try and shed some light on what's happening. And the reason we can calibrate those things is, as you've said, through the preserved evidence that we have of time periods of Earth's history, forgotten worlds, if you like. So fossils, for example, are a window into creatures that roamed across the Earth's surface and interacted with things at that time that no longer exist. And so they are these tiny little clues. It's almost like being a detective, like Sherlock Holmes in a way, just trying to pick up these fragments of evidence that are kind of scattered around and ultimately trying to build a picture or build some sort of collage of the whodunit, if you like. Fossils are one thing. In many ways, in my experience, minerals can effectively be the same thing. If you think about tree rings, trees can have these kind of shells that grow incrementally over time that preserve the history of that tree as it's grown. And you know, there might be a particularly wet summer or a particularly cold winter, for example, and that really influences the thickness of those tree rings, for example. Minerals are exactly the same. They grow at different rates and according to different types of processes over their entire growth history. And those processes are preserved in terms of the chemical zoning in the minerals themselves. So just like tree rings, you could look at an element like silicon, for example, or calcium or magnesium or iron or whatever it might be. And that fluctuates as the mineral grows in response to all of these environmental variables. So we can, with the power of microscopes, with the power of analytical tools, we can look deep within a mineral, basically, and pick up all of these clues as to what changed over its growth history and what that might reflect in terms of the temperature changes that it experienced, for example, the pressure changes that it experienced, the changes in the fluids that it was interacting with, all of these sort of things. And so we use these clues, just like we use tree rings or just like we use fossils, to reconstruct what the life cycle was for that particular mineral or that particular system of rocks that it was associated with.
Once again, Tom has truly outdone himself with the amount of detail he uses to discuss these topics.
And the constant use of analogies to make everything so much easier to understand. I'm just glad he explained what a principle of uniformitarianism is.
What this shows us is that once again, we have to respect and understand the invisible processes of the Earth, because so much work and time and effort goes into learning and understanding these concepts to uncover the invisible processes themselves, and yet so many of them go almost unnoticed.
Is there a way that people can view these processes, preferably without spending the time getting a degree in geology or glaciology?
Well, there are a few ways, but some aren't that simple. If you want to explore what planet Earth has to offer, the first place would be to come to MOD. MOD's new invisibility exhibition showcases a brilliant display of some of Earth's invisible processes. Tom himself has been part of a study conducted by Alicia Pollitt that has influenced the geology exhibit at MOD.
That's pretty awesome, but who exactly is Alicia Pollitt?
Well, I'll get to that in a second, but if you want to look at a range of different minerals or fossils or even look into some of South Australia's polar science history, well, I'll get to that in a second, but if you want to look at a range of different minerals or fossils or even look into some of South Australia's polar science history, the best place to go would be the South Australian Museum. Or, if you would like to look a little closer, Tom has worked with the Macquarie University to develop a virtual microscope that scans rocks and minerals so you can examine them up to the most minute detail.
Hold on, Sam. You said before that we would look at geology's invisible processes and how they impact or influence South Australia. And you tell me about Alicia Pollitt.
I absolutely did.
Well, how does it? And I still don't know. Who is Alicia?
Let's ask the expert.
Alicia was a PhD student of mine. She graduated last year in 2020. And she was working on looking at the heat flow field of Southern Australia. Now, you might not know that rocks contribute a very small but very important radiation of heat from the Earth. And that has a role to play in all sorts of different interactions within the Earth system. The one that Alicia was most interested in is how that may potentially impact ice sheet dynamics. Because what the unique scenario that we have in Southern Australia is that we are the direct correlative of eastern Antarctica. So in other words, the rocks that occur on the southern margin of Australia are the exact same that occur along the eastern margin of Antarctica, because the two continents were once conjoined and then ultimately separated due to plate tectonics and continental drift and all that kind of stuff. So the rocks that we have exposed in southern Australia, we can study intensively to look at their thermal properties, basically, how much heat they contribute naturally via radioactive decay. The reason we want to understand that is, of course, in Antarctica, if we teleport across there, these rocks sit beneath kilometers of ice. And even though the heat produced by rocks is relatively small in terms of total thermal output, what it does is it creates a lubricating layer, basically a layer of meltwater that allows the ice sheet to move more rapidly across the interface that it has with the ice. So if we can better constrain how much thermal input is being provided by these rocks and how that influences ice sheet behavior, we can better predict how sea level is likely to change into the future, for example. And the reason that that's so critical in the areas Alicia was studying, which was out on the Nullarbor Plains, for example, is that when you connect that back to Antarctica, it actually joins to the Totten Glacier, and that the catchment area for the Totten Glacier, which alone could account potentially, if it melted, for about 3.5 meters of sea level rise. So a huge catchment area, a really significant contributor to the ice sheet dynamics of Antarctica as a whole. And so a really unique opportunity for her to look at the Australia and Antarctica connection and how the discoveries that we can make in southern Australia can really help us better constrain things that we could never directly observe in Antarctica.
Okay, so we've just done one big loop.
We absolutely have. Climate change has such a significant impact on planet Earth that while some of its processes are indeed still invisible, it's impacting a range of fields of study and not just the world itself.
But it's not all doom and gloom. Today we've explored some truly amazing invisible processes and how you can see some of them for yourselves.
Although it is important to understand our human impact, it is also an opportunity to learn and explore once invisible processes we've now opened your mind to.
That brings this episode of Modcast to an end.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Modcast's next episode will explore data privacy. We hope to see you there.
This is 3 of 4 episodes in Modcast Season 5 Invisibility. This episode was produced by Sam Lowe and senior produced by Caitlin Ellen Moore from Radio Adelaide. Thanks to Tom Raimondo and Nathan Tedder for their insights in this episode. And thanks also to Lisa Bailey, Lisa Burns and Natalie Kafora for additional series support and resources. Modcast Series 5 Invisibility is presented by Mod at the University of South Australia and is linked to an exhibition which you can find at mod.org.au or in person.